So hello everyone, welcome back to our second episode of Sani Podcast. I'm really excited to be here this afternoon. And first of all, I would like to thank every single one who gave us very good feedback on our first episode. The support and the very good feedback that we received, we are really, really grateful. For those of us joining us for the first time, this is the Sani Podcast, where we celebrate African scientists and their marvelous work that they are doing in the continent and also in the diaspora as well.
Today, we are honored to have with us Josephine Marie Godwill, a PhD student at the School of Community Resources and Development in Arizona State University. She is interested in studying interactions with socio-ecotechnical systems, SETs, and how they can inform planning, management, and policy decisions. Her research over the years has focused on examining how social norms, values, power structures, and technology shape environmental and social behavioral outcomes. She is the founding director of Young at Heart Ghana, a multi-award-winning educational technology social enterprise that has partnered with international organizations like World Vision and General Electric to reach over 5,000 youth through digital training program platforms. So thank you so much for joining us, Josephine Marie Godwill.
Before we go ahead with our questions, we just wanted to introduce ourselves. You've not really known us from our last episode. My name is Alex Nyako. And I'll be hosting this podcast with
Selassie Biafrekwache.
So I want to zoom into our first point of discussion for today. And we wanted to talk about, Josephine, your educational background, really giving us that connection back to Africa. Just tell us about where you started from, the intermediary step, where you are now, and what really brought you to the point that you are now. So really looping it back to that background in Africa.
Yeah, so thank you once again for having me. It's a pleasure to catch up and to reconnect. So I grew up in Ghana, Koforidua to be precise. Koforidua is still a peri-urban community. So it's in between a rural and urban setting. So it's urban enough to not require that I would have had to, you know, like go to a borehole and fetch water. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as urban to have like multiple traffic lights, right? So we had traffic lights in for the majority of the time that I grew up in Koforidua and one roundabout. So that was one of the key things that people would measure our urbanness by. I grew up in a setting which was very community centric, and so I think that my experiences as a young girl really gave me the opportunity to cherish social systems and communities. It was a residential bungalow for government officials. My dad worked with the ministries as the regional economic planning officer. And I remember every weekend we had the opportunity to host people from neighboring communities. And so there would be people that would come just so that they could watch TV, for example, at my home. There were kids from neighboring communities that would come, so I'd play with them, which was good because I was an only child, right? So my neighbors, majority of them were boys. I think that was really instrumental in shaping in my mind what was, in quote, appropriate or otherwise, right? So if I had, for example, if I had siblings that were girls, I probably would, you know, lean more towards, you know, ampe or whatever it may be, which is but because I had this mixed mash of neighbors coming to play. I was playing soccer. I used to play police and thief, like, you know, chase around, you know. And it sort of shaped the way I saw things in school as well. So in school, there was no I didn't have that mentality of, you know, science is for boys, math is for boys. Yeah. So yeah. Again, it shows how the fluidity of play carrying on to my academics or the way I viewed schooling. And so I didn't really have any favorite subject in school. Just like I did a lot of back and forth between the things that I did at home. In school, I like the sciences, I like math, I did very well in social studies, I did very well in religion. You know, languages were my Achilles heel because I didn't like French and Cree. But apart from that, I was pretty rounded. And that has sort of been the case for my academic, you know, viewpoint or pursuit, you know, right from my childhood to this point, because I quite remember when I was selecting the course I would read in high school, I really wanted to do science, but then I also wanted to do geography, right? Which was odd. And the school I went to, arguably the best high school in Ghana, was the high school where I met Dr. in the making, Caitlin. You know, didn't have that option. So I sort of stuck with doing the usual biology, physics, and chemistry and elective math. But I really remember, you know, continuously saying that I would have chosen to drop biology if I got the opportunity, and I would have wanted to do geography. Considering the experience I had had with my dad, you know, studying remote sensing when he was a younger man. So that also influenced the sort of things that I wanted to do. Moving on from there to tech, I finally got the opportunity to infuse geography into the things that I was interested in. And so I read geomatic engineering, which focuses on using modern mapping techniques to collect data, to visualize, analyze, and present data in different formats. Got the opportunity to do a bit of IT because of the information systems bits attached to that. And it was during this time that I again sought to look at the different interactions that take place amongst systems, right? So I was always interested in, again, going back to my childhood, these social systems, community, how to use technology to facilitate understanding these social systems. And then basically the interactions amongst these systems. All came full circle. It started coming full circle when I went for an outreach with Pax Romana. It was called RUDEP, Rural Development Education Project. Got to a village, loved the place. But I noticed that throughout those projects, kids that were in this community weren't so much. I knew that there were things they needed, but then I was also fascinated by their assets that they had. Right, so storytelling was a big thing in the community. So every evening they'll gather around. You know, a daddy or a mom will tell them about stories, and I noticed that more and more teachers would use storytelling as a way of engaging kids in the community school, I thought. Lacking, however, was this, access to technology, right? So they didn't have access to computers, for example. Everything that they learned was on the blackboard. And so while there was an asset, there was also a need. And for me, in my mind, it was how do you accentuate the assets-based things in that community and bridge the gaps for their needs, right? And so how does storytelling and technology come together to create a solution to, you know, the challenges they may face, but then also highlight the assets that they have within their environment. And that's what led to Young at Heart, and I'm sure that we'll be talking about that a bit more. After, you know, my bachelor's and then my master's all in geomatic engineering, my interest in interactions among social, ecological, and technical systems finally came full circle when I got the opportunity to do a PhD in understanding how these interactions take place and how they inform social behavioral outcomes. And how they can inform policies, right? So rather than making policies just based on the technical level, how do we understand the interactions amongst the boxes? So it's not just thinking outside the box or thinking within the boxes, thinking between the boxes, to make decisions that supports the concerns, the assets, the society, while making use of technology and being aware of the context that we find all these different things in. So that's in a long story short, my journey and how, you know, the experiences I had when I was small has shaped the concerns and the interests that I have with branches in practice and research as well.
I find it very interesting how your growing up has really influenced your final, well, not final, but where you are currently. And so you've talked about, you just started talking about your research, which is examining how the social norms, power structures and technologies shape these environmental and social behavioral outcomes. So can you just give us an overview of what exactly you do in your research currently at Arizona State University?
Yeah, so great question. So I found that, you know, one of the reasons why I decided to go to ASU was this lens they have on for transdisciplinary research, right? So our president, Michael Crow, would always say that, you know, the world is not silo. So as much as we like to segment issues and try to address problems by creating disciplines, you know, the world doesn't work like that, right? So if, for example, as a medical practitioner, if you wanted to reach out to the community with medicine, you can't just go there and give them medicine. You have to understand the context within which you're providing this medicine. You have to understand what their views are, what the taboos are, how they would react to this intervention, go through a family head rather than going straight to a woman that you want to introduce whatever intervention for. So it piqued my interest, and for most of the work that I have done, I have looked exactly at these. I've looked at the interactions that take place amongst these social systems, and then looked at how technology can be used to further understand and then to communicate these interactions, and then outcomes on, you know, on the environment. And so typically one work that I did, which is quite recent, was to look at how built environments within a tourism-centric community influences stress, right? So most of the time when we think about tourism, we are likely to concentrate on the economic benefits of tourism. And so if you have a tourism site in a particular place, then you're thinking of how it's creating employment, how it's bringing income to the different communities. What we forget to look at is the implications on well-being, larger, beyond, you know, the economic benefits. And so for such a study, I was instrumental in creating this, you know, geodatabase system where the people that we engaged in could geocode their locations at any point and report whether they were stressed or not. And essentially what I did then was to do an analysis and look at what are the things around the places where they are reporting different levels of stress. And it was interesting to know that in communities where they had this high tourism-centric focus, they were reporting stress very close to tourism sites. The interactions that took place, tourists that were there to use the sites, things like crowding, things like, I really want to use the bathroom, but there's a long line because there are a bunch of tourists in the community at that time, were all negatively influencing the residents that were in that community. And so by geocoding the areas where they were experiencing stress using technology and trying to understand the interactions that take place amongst the social agents, I could, use technology to better understand these interactions and you know, make advice on some of the key things that the city of Sedona's, where we did the study, should be looking at. Some of the key things were, you know, they had one major road, for example, and so traffic on that road was really bad. Imagine having a small town, one major road, all these tourists coming in, and you just want to get to the mall to get to pick something. Yeah, and wow. So that interaction alone was very telling on the people in the tourism-centric community. And for people that were in a tourism non-centric community, they didn't even report that any tourist site was a major problem. Right. They reported stress randomly across the different parts of their community. So that's a typical example of what I have done in research. And most of the work that I have done also has focused on transportation choices for, you know, kids in the United States, but looking at what environmental characteristics are influencing these transportation choices. Mm. Example, an interesting outcome for one that we are working on is we found that people, kids that lived close to food-related land use areas were likely to walk to school, even if they were within close proximity to the school. And it was surprising because I thought, well, if you could pass McDonald's on your way back to school, it should be one of the reasons why you walk. But increasingly, the research shows that there's a certain fear for the sorts of interactions that take place in those places, right? So you could have, you know, not to be demeaning, but you could have homeless populations very close to these places. Right. And parents are not comfortable with their kids walking, you know, on that. Mm. While we see things as very big picture, there are ways of understanding how, you know, people make different choices and the outcomes thereof based on the interactions that take place amongst these different elements in the broader mm-hmm. that we look at, which begs for more research and allows us to create solutions or policies that are context specific or context aware rather than, you know, this overall umbrella jacket of, you know, trying to create, you know, solutions and developments and policies that are based on rather generic, more than, you know, context specific interactions. And those are the things I'm interested in, which normally isn't the pathway for a lot of people that have an engineering background, largely positivist. But I find a way of allowing my interpretivist viewpoints to permeate the circles I'm in. And a lot of people find it very frustrating, but I think that it's exciting to always have a different lens through which you're looking at things.
Right.
Yeah. Mixed by conversation.
Yeah, I think it also reflects what you said, thinking between the boxes. So really taking the ideas from and the skill sets from the engineering training and bringing that into this setting as well, mm-hmm. making it much more relevant and making it as a tool for solving these problems and using those skills. I find that very intriguing. Yeah. So wanted to shift a bit from your research and really talk about Young at Heart. So tell us about Young at Heart and what was the foundational motive for setting up this nonprofit.
Yeah, so I mean, it all started with that one trip, that one rural development education project trip, right? So right from, again, linking it back to how I grew up, I, you know, cherished this opportunity to be communal. I have always, I mean, if I had to create like an order of priority, I'd most likely put my social system and people that surround me as primary. I really, really, really cherish you know, being able to live in a society where I somebody else has my back. I know that I'm alone. It's not an individualistic venture, right? And so when I was young, and I remember we'd go to Accra and all the villages along the road will have kids just, you know, like in belly clad and cry all the way from Kofredia to Accra because I felt bad that, you know, people, you know, kids didn't have clothes to wear. These kids, I'm sure, were happy and going about their lives very excitedly. But I took on the burden of feeling bad because I felt like they weren't getting enough or they didn't have what I had. And so RUDEP was a very culminating, you know, time in my life where everything sort of came together and I understood that, you know, I definitely must be here for something more than just realizing my goals and dreams and studying and learning. And I'm not bashing knowledge for the sake of knowledge, but that I should definitely have some sort of larger influence on society beyond the things that I yearn for. And so during that period, it was a time which was a time for me to be reflective. But what really started Young at Heart was a promise that I had made to the people that I met at Brady. Brady is where I was allocated. It was the furthest in Kufuor camp. and the funny story is that my co-founder at that time, I mean, we were friends from Kofredia, and he wasn't my co-founder at Young at Heart, but he was the one in charge of allocation for RUDEP. And he took me to the village, took me to the furthest points we could ever think of, but it's all good. I don't hold it against him anymore, but I really so I told them that when we were leaving by the end of 2 weeks, I told them I'll come back. And the kids were excited because we took our laptops and we thought them, you know, ICT with our laptops. And so they were sad that I was taking it away. But then I was like, oh, don't worry, we'll come back. And nobody in the village believed me because apparently that's what everybody says. You go to a community, you have an outreach and you say, oh, we'll come back. And that's sort of like a bye-bye.
Yeah.
Out of here. Good riddance, right? And for me, that the mistrust that they had in me, but more essentially my commitment to, you know, communal living, because it wasn't just, for me, it wasn't just saying that I'll come back. I really meant that I will come back. And anytime that we thought of going back to do this outreach and there were challenges and we could have easily given up, it was the word that I gave them and their feeling that I wouldn't come back that continued to push me. So essentially, what did we do? What we did was that we came back and I got the opportunity to be a teaching assistant in Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. And that's where I did my my bachelor's. And so by being a teaching assistant, I had access to students, right? And one key thing or connection between students in universities is their connection to their laptops. Everybody, not everybody, most people have laptops because you have laptops. And so there I saw an opportunity to, you know, increase the number of devices that we could have access to in order to organize an outreach to remote community that didn't have, you know, computers. And more essentially, I felt that beyond using computers for information and communication technology, which is a subject that they learn, we could use technology as a way of helping them to understand other subjects as well, because technology really is a platform and a channel, an interface, right? And it can connect to other things because the research shows that it's interactive, it helps, you know, with engagement when used rightly. And so what we did was to connect with teachers that were interested in such a venture to create models. So we created models on ICT, created science and then English models, essentially using different programs. And these were very basic generic programs like Microsoft Paint, Word, to see how we could engage them to learn other subjects. And the first one we did was in 2013, September 21st, 2013. And what we did was to travel to this community and then organize a workshop, a day-long workshop where kids were learning different things using computers over a period. And so they learned science, they learned English that day, and then also ICT. and the excitement, the fact that, you know, they heard that we were coming, and so there was such a huge turnout for a rural community on a Saturday when most kids are going to the farm to and all that. We had a full turnout and they were very excited. And so that, you know, sort of excitement grew, and we were like, okay, we wanted to do just this one term thing, but then let's take it to the next village. And so by the time we realized we're doing monthly outreaches, teaching kids using computers every month, and we had already reached five villages in that community. And that's when we had to take a step back, because of course we're excited that we're getting numbers, people were coming, but then we had to question how sustainable it was, because you don't go to a community, introduce computers, they get the experience, and then you take your computers back. And so what we sought them to do was to partner with a community school there, and we asked them if they were willing to give us a room in that school, because they had quite a number of rooms. If they were willing to give us a room, that we would raise funds and get computers so that the surrounding schools could use that spot as an IT hub. And so we did that. And in all this, the surprising thing is the way students came on board. And I mean, like university students came on board and rallied to get this done. Because the notion, again, sometimes is that you don't get people to volunteer in Ghanaian contexts, and right, they would be paid for what they do. But the way of looking at it is they want value for the work they do. Now, whether it's monetary or it's emotional or it's societal, it's what we don't often look at. So you think that people won't work for free. People will work for value. You need to find what value they are looking for. And for us, the value we gave them was a network. It was fun. I'm a very fun-loving person. It came to bear and it benefited us all. There were times when in the bus, people looked more forward to having that encounter in the bus than they did living in the village, because we would play games. At their call and at their request, I was always available to have meetings with them if they were looking at either applying for schools outside. At that time, I hadn't even thought of going to school outside, or they were looking for reference letters. So that value was important to offer them. Yes. It's a social system, and that communal thinking element, right? Important. That was a side note. And so we got that IT hub established, and still we were looking for even more sustainable ways of doing things. At this time, we had a core team made up of volunteers that were in different departments. We had a patron who was Professor Ampedu in the School of College of Engineering. And Martin, who's my co-founder now, had come on board. And so, again, that support system was important. Finding people that are like-minded, who are excited about technology and teaching kids with technology, was also very important. We wanted to create an authentic experience beyond using these generic platforms to teach the students that we reached out to. And so going back to interactions, social interactions, and what was special or what was an asset in these communities, storytelling, right? So we all with Anas's stories. In those contexts, it was even more pronounced because the sources of leisure and recreation were very limited. And so put together a team, very minimal amount of money available. All this time, we're relying on our national service money. Put together a team, created a software that uses Anas's stories to teach subjects. And because we had created this, and it was something that I think was valuable beyond the context that we were trying to use it in, we would talk to investors, and they thought the idea was pretty neat. Because it was using African folklore and bridging that gap between indigenous knowledge and what we had come to understand as Western scientific knowledge, right? So bridging that gap, using Anansi stories to teach things like machines, right? So if Anansi, in an Anansi story, Anansi carried a python or a snake with a stick, we're teaching machines with that because there's a lever right there, there's a fulcrum, you're putting a load on the stake. And so it was bridging that gap between how people saw indigenous knowledge and, you know, science. And trying to say is that, you know, there is science in Africa. It's intuitive to us, but we can still link it to what the West would call science. That was done. We have the second version of the app under development. We also still wanted to hammer on sustainability. And so we created these wheel carts that contains, custom-built technology with the apps on it. And so essentially kids that we reach out to don't have to travel to another community to use the computer. If you have a cart and you don't have even enough classrooms, you can convert your already existing classrooms to a technology lab. And so that's how we have grown. And it's still a very grassroots, organic organization such that we have volunteer basis still. I'm on every single WhatsApp page. It's important that you keep the interaction going. And for me, it's really the essence of, I think that's one of the essences for why I'm here, and it draws on all other aspects of my life. I don't see it as just, you know, a technology-based organization. I see it as a family that is looking at empowering others with the knowledge that we have. So that's a little bit, I get really young at heart. I can go on and on and on, and we can talk about it the whole day, but
yeah.
Of course, yeah.
I think that the passion really shows.
Yeah, it's a little baby which is growing steadily. So,
So, wanted to go back to if you could describe what Anansi is to our non-Ghanaian listeners and viewers, so that they can also get the context and apply it to the whole story itself.
Yeah, so Anansi is the original Spider-Man.
I like that.
Yes. Before there was Spider-Man, there was Anansi. Stories in Africa are everything, right? So everything that we do is associated to the stories that we have grown up listening to. It's the primary way that we pass on knowledge. And so in other cultures, you have a lot of like written history, right? But in our context, a lot of that is oral. And so the way we pass down our histories through, you know, oral methods and storytelling is critical to that. The way that we have been taught about morals has been through stories, right? So if you wanted to teach some morals to your kids, you're likely to channel that through a story. And the fulcrum of all these stories are Anansi's stories. So Anansi is the hero of folklore, especially in the Ghanaian context. He is a man and a spider at the same time, very wise. But sometimes his wisdom is mistaken as trickery, right? So sometimes he's too wise for his own good. And so there are so many different moral stories that have been, and extensively these have been explored, like trying to pass down ethics and morals, what you should do, the consequences of different actions through Anansi's stories. Explored, however, is what we are trying to engage with, which is the intuitive, scientific, if you would want to say, or indigenous lessons that are associated to the stories. I mentioned, for example, the science lesson that has been attached to the story of how Anansi's stories came to be called Anansi. Okay. Where he's asked to get different things from the forest, one of which is getting a snake, and he uses a stick, ties the snake down, and then carries it to Nana Yankopong. There are other math stories, you know, there are stories where he decides to get all the food in the land to himself. And so that is a way of doing, you know, lessons on nutrition, like what are the food that he collected. There are stories where he tries to gather all the wisdom in the world into a pot, right? And that, for us, we relate it to technology where, you know, you're gathering all this knowledge into a particular server or whatever it is, and then you can tap into that knowledge. So I think that we have underexplored those sides of things, and we are missing out on opportunities to use those same things as a channel to teach everyday things that kids learn at school. And so science becomes so burdensome because it's unrelatable. But related to these things and everyday things you find at home, like salt and sugar, and you're not thinking about cauliflower and broccoli, which is not Ghanaian, you know, it makes it easier to understand and pass down knowledge. And so that's Anansi and what we are trying to do to use that as a channel for STEM in general.
I really think it's very inspiring how you perceive things, especially with looking at how all these we've not tapped into these stories that have been passed down from our forefathers and mothers. And it's very common to go to the village and you have all these stories that have been told. And one of the things that I've always thought about is, I think just like you have, you're using with younger heart, I think all these stories, we can actually tap into them and use it as a platform to teach our young people different subjects or different concepts that will make it more familiar, and maybe talk about contemporary instead of broccoli, because how many people have seen broccoli? And so it's very inspiring that you took an experience from an extracurricular activity and built it into this enterprise. And so one of our questions that we have for you is, what has Young at Heart exposed about STEM in Africa? And I know you've talked a little bit about this, and then how do you think we can make STEM more attractive to the youth? What do you see in terms of STEM, like 5 years, 10 years from now, how do you see STEM in Africa?
So I think that's a great question. The first thing is the fact that it's not, STEM is not a foreign thing. It's not something that is foreign to Africans. Mm-hmm. The way it may be perceived or pursued might be, it might not be local to our context, but it's still not something that is beyond us. It's not something that is unlike us, right? So in Western contexts, a lot of the ways in which knowledge is pursued is rational, right? So we have a number of steps that we go through in order to realize information at the end. In a lot of African contexts, it's intuitive, right? And so we know things. And, you know, I was listening to the first podcast, and, you know, one of the key things that the speaker spoke about was the fact that it's important to tap into these indigenous knowledge because they have acquired over a period of time, and it costs so much to do longitudinal studies in order to realize some of the knowledge that has been acquired already in these. African populations have been a resident in the context that they're in for a very, very long time, and it makes good for longitudinal studies, right? Even though it's formalized as longitudinal studies, you go to a community and they'll tell you not to touch this grass, and if you touch it, you will fall sick. If you don't listen to it based on the experiences they've had and you touch it, you will fall sick. And as to whether they have gone through systemic, you know, procedures and have tested it in the laboratory to come to that realization, or they have come to that realization through intuitive methods, does not change the fact that you will fall sick if you touch those plants, right? And so it's important, and that is what we have been hammering in Young at Heart, to understand that the knowledge is not foreign to, you know, the African person or the African man. We have come to deal with through different means and methods. It's important to value that and to find ways maybe of documenting that or translating that to other contexts, but it doesn't make it inferior in any way, shape or form to the processes that are adopted by, you know, Western technologies.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I think that that has been a key realization in trying to fit, you know, these lessons to the stories that exist already. You know, we are not forcing, you know, kids or forcing lessons into stories. We are only exposing the lessons that are already existent in these stories.
Yeah.
So it helps in bridging those gaps and really allowing us to embrace the realization that, you know, discovery, knowledge, innovation is something that is very African and should be understood as African and not necessarily a foreign concept that is forced down our throat. And once we are able to realize that, once we understand how to make the most of the things that are within our context, then we can create our own ways of adapting these technologies into things that are useful and helpful to us. Not relying on, you know, Western technologies and cultures. You know, there's so many stories of how Western science learns from midwives, for example, in Africa, on you know, ways of childbirth and delivery and all that. So first of all, it's the first working on the mindset, understanding that within our context, there's knowledge and there are things that we need to highlight and hammer and adapt. And then, you know, how do we help the rest of the world? It's not always a one-sided relationship where they are bringing things down for us to contribute, but we have something to contribute to. And so when you look at it that way, it's a very big picture thing, but it's important that we start thinking that way. So that is what Nyangarara has contributed in realizing and STEM. And that is what we are focused on, and hopefully we want to extend this even beyond African context to other indigenous populations, and the larger conversation around knowledge, that it's not just scientific, Western scientific, but it's indigenous knowledge, Western scientific knowledge, so that it complements each other. I hope my answer wasn't too theoretical.
No, it was perfect. So we'd like to gradually bring our conversation to an end, but wanted to get a brief look into what is the life of a usual STEM educator like? And then as a follow-up to that question, what advice will you give to upcoming STEM educators in Ghana, in Africa, and even in other areas, as you are alluding to, as you want to expand to other indigenous communities?
That's a great question. So I think that there are two major crops of STEM educators. So maybe three. So the first one is the typical, is a one that has a lens of need on, right? So there's an identified need and there are deprived contexts. And what we need in order to meet these needs is to rely on technology, laboratory equipment, other things that are needed in order to bring kids that are at a certain level to another level, which is desirable.
Mm-hmm.
For such educators, you'd have a lot of these campaigns where you see, you know, campaigns for donation of laboratory equipment, books, whatever it is. And I don't fault that approach, because it's important to expose young people, especially in the context of Africa, to different ways of thinking and ways of learning, right? And if that's an approach. And then you have the second group that I would subscribe to, and I think that most people in Nyangarara think that way, which is, what can we do with what we have, and how do we explore our current settings to push for STEM education, and now we even add an A, which is STEAM. So what are the different contextual elements we should be thinking about? Again, it comes to these interactions, right? How do we create solutions that are context aware, are supported by the context that we are in? How do we tap into our environment to look for solutions to support STEM education? And I would mention DEXT technology as a quintessential example of great guys that are doing amazing. So they have this science set, they have, you know, different wires and elements within the set, and using that set, most of the materials are sourced in Ghana. It's Ghanaian made, Ghanaian born industry. You can do science experiments using that small box, right? For young at heart, it's using everyday materials and then an app to learn science and using stories to learn science. So that's the second bracket of a STEM educator. And then the third ones are sort of like a mixture of the two. So they acknowledge that they need certain things, like these are typically robotics clubs, for example, right? You need to have these robots. And even in that context, I know people that are creating their own robots in Ghana, so maybe it's not really an excuse, but they rely a lot on, you know, foreign aid, foreign materials, in order to help students understand these higher level concepts, right? Going to space, whatever it may be. So these are the three major brackets. And I don't fault, all of them have their pros and cons. I subscribe more to the second phase, where you are relying on the context that you are in and trying to create solutions. And I think that it makes for a much richer learning experience. But one and three are also very critical and important. So that's how I would broadly categorize, you know, STEM education in Ghana or in Africa. And I think the question was, where do we go from here, and what's the future? What does it look like? I think a healthy combination of all three categories. But again, I'll be biased and say hammer on two, because when you hammer on two, you come up with a lot more innovative solutions that are built for the context within which you are in. To also contribute to a wider context, so that it's not just that you are consuming information always from the Western world or relying so much on your needs, but you're also contributing something positively to STEM in general in the world. And so for Young at Heart, we are hoping that this is going to grow. We are hoping that it won't be an organization that only reaches out to Africans, but it's an organization that reaches out to indigenous populations all across the world to, you know, further understand and to bridge these gaps between indigenous and Western science. And I think that we are able to complement each other. There's so much more that we can learn, and there's so much more that we can tap into. The medicines that we can come up with, that it may be hidden in some village or the book that we have no idea of, that we are missing out on, would definitely be the thing of the past. So that's the big dream, and hopefully we can all dream together.
Definitely. Really, you know, lofty goals, really big goals, not just for Ghana, but for the world as a whole. And I think it's for me very inspiring to see how we are taking the local content and being innovative to teach and to cause there to be a growth in our people. So thank you. Thank you so much for taking the initiative. And Amabo, thank you really for spending time with us to talk about your research, to talk about Young at Heart, and you really talk about your passions. And we could see the passion with how you're expressing these ideas and these thoughts. So thank you once again, Josephine. And thank you, everyone who is tuning in to watch us, tuning in to listen to us on Spotify. We are grateful for coming in today, coming in to really learn about what Josephine is working on and learn about STEM education in Africa. And we hope that you've really been inspired, just like we all of us been inspired. And kindly check the description in below to look at Josephine's tech talk that she gave, and also to check out her website for Young at Heart as well.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for having me. And this is an amazing platform. I keep saying that it's very timely and it's here at the right time. And thank you so much for the time you've spent in putting together this concept and reaching out to us as speakers to speak. It's very, very much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you so much, Josephine, as well. So see you all at our next session. You can find us on Facebook as Sani, on Instagram as at Sani, so the at sign with Sani, and on YouTube as Sani Podcasts. So don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. So thank you all, and we will be talking again soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.